Blog Talk Radio.
Pigs can fly. Sharks are coming out of the sea and walking on land. Obamacare mania is sweeping the nation, brother. Russia is going to make sure that Syria manages their chemical weapons properly. Dixie Carter's a heel. Scraggly bearded Daniel Bryan is a top babyface in the WWE. Can all of these things be real? Hey, man. That's up to you, because perception is reality. And that's the name of this podcast. We are on the air right here on the GWH Radio Network. I am Trent Van Dries, and I am currently joined by my two co-hosts. First of all, the man behind the switchboard, the Georgia legend, the man that can make or break your professional wrestling career with one keystroke, Scary Larry Goodman. How you doing, Larry?
I'm doing fine. That was quite an intro you gave there. I'm impressed.
I spent all of about, I spent a good 10 minutes thinking of that today. Was it okay?
Yeah.
I've left one part off, though. I'm kind of kicking myself. Stephanie McMahon had a line on Raw on Monday night that I love. She said that Big Show was living in a cul-de-sac of disappointment. I meant to work that out a little bit, but I missed it. And how'd you like that intro music? I mean, Larry, you kind of left me hanging. You were supposed to touch base with me. We get on the line the minute before we go on. You say there's some kind of an intro and something about Rich Tate is getting it up. The first time in 2013, the man has got it up. And, Larry, that sounded like porn music.
I don't know what to say. I thought there was going to be – apparently we just got the music without the words on that intro. So.
Oh.
Maybe Rich Tate didn't get it up after all. You know, I'm really not sure.
Well, Larry, perception is reality. And let me introduce our other co-host. And let's just go ahead and say the star of this show, the most powerful man in the Southeast of professional wrestling, the one and only Bill Behrens. Bill, welcome to Perception is Reality. How are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderfully, and I am underwhelmed so far on our ability to deliver anything substantial, and that will probably lead us to Steve Platinum.
Wow.
Oh no, well, I'm sorry. That was just badly done and a really bad pun. But still at the same time, it's the way we need to be doing things. What I think we're hoping to accomplish here is to do something better than what's done repeatedly on the various over-air things that are happening out of Georgia wrestling history. We want to establish something better. So the idea here is we're going to take broader strokes. We're going to talk about bigger things. We're going to maybe actually discuss something that matters rather than just interviewing somebody that happens to be on the show who doesn't really matter because they're trying to get somewhere. So hopefully that's the direction we're going in. And I think that's something to aspire to. And hopefully all of us who are along for the ride are aspiring to that too. Our opinion will matter, but in the bigger picture, it's what are we trying to deliver? What's the message? And is there an end game? And I think in the reality, we'll establish whether we're doing that in what we do, in each and everything we interact in. So I think Larry Goodman is an excellent decision. You bring a perspective that I have often found unique, and Steve Platinum has real credibility in my eyes.
Oh, so I'm not credible. Well, Bill, let me ask you this. Did you ever think that you and I would be on a podcast together in your wildest dreams?
It might not have been a dream, but it is a reality. And accordingly, I can adjust. You know, your opinion represents a wide opinion, because your opinion frequently comes without knowing what really you're talking about. And I think in the bigger picture, if we understand that you're bringing an opinion that's based on what you know and what you see rather than what you can really know and what really is happening, that's an important opinion. And Larry's done that for years in what he's reviewed. He's tried not to impact on what he knows rather than what he sees. And Steve and I have the unique perspective that we actually know what's going on sometimes. And that's different. So I think we have a unique group of people that are involved, and Steve will have a unique role in what we're doing. And I think I'm excited about that. I think there's an opportunity to talk beyond the normal, stupid conversation that has appeared periodically on what George Lincoln history. Sometimes it's been very, very good, but only when somebody actually steps up and talks about something. Otherwise, there's just people putting themselves over.
I couldn't agree more, Bill. I couldn't agree more. And Larry, by the way, I loved your line too, whoever wrote the line, that we are going to venture off the beaten path and down the rabbit hole of professional wrestling. That was a really great line, Larry. Nice
take
job
the
there.
Pill. The story ends. Oh. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
How many times
and
have
I'm
you
appreciative
used
that we have a. I think it's really important that we have the deepest possible rabbit hole.
Well, Larry, on that note, is our guest for tonight on the line, or shall we carry on?
We have someone on the line. I do not know if it's him.
Okay, well, I'll just go ahead and say it right now. Now, if anybody listening to the show live right now, if your perception of reality is you have something important to say, feel free to call us, 347-324-5735, and we will decide whether you're right or not. So with that in mind, Larry, why don't we go ahead and see who has something to add to our brilliant conversation so far.
Okay, area code 111. You're the first guest on Perception is Reality.
There is no area code 111.
Well, that's what's coming up on the screen.
111 is Skype, guys. That's what that is, that's Skype.
Yes. So I'm alerting whoever it is on Skype.
It's a Skype thing. Ah, the kids in their Skype. I understand it. Okay. So this person is likely naked.
Well, what do you think that for?
Because it's Skype.
Oh, I've never Skyped, Bill. I'm kind of new to these kind of things. I don't know. People Skype naked often.
Exactly. And I only know what I hear, and what I hear just simply, there's a bunch of people just trying to interact naked. That's what happens on Skype. That's what they do.
Well, not
but
only
anyway,
is this person...
I'm assuming there's someone with an intelligent opinion that wants presented. So,
please do.
Well, they're not presenting, so I don't know what the story is. Is there anybody there from Skype? No. So never mind.
Maybe they're naked and they have like duct tape across their mouth and various appendages, tied up and things.
Well, we can only hope. What I had hoped we were going to do as we went forward is what we need to do is address not something specific necessarily, but something in generalities that we can discuss that other people can embrace. One of the things I've worked with over the years is that I've tried to help people realize a career in wrestling. And not more often than not, I'm not paid for that, but it's what I do. Sometimes I've been paid for that, which is nice. You know, sometimes WWE has paid me, WCW has paid me, other people have paid me. But I don't always get paid by the people I help. But the key is, what makes somebody a star in wrestling? How do they get there? And one of the things I think is important as we look at what makes a professional wrestler is what they can bring to the table that's unique and how they accomplish that. And unique doesn't mean that you have to be, you know, the boogeyman, yet he was unique and he got paid for a while. But sometimes that uniqueness is short-termed. So what you have to figure out is what makes you unique? How do you stand out? What creates a character? And that's more challenging today than ever before.
Larry, you got anything to add? I got a lot to add, but go ahead, Larry.
Go for it. I'm dealing with callers. Go ahead.
Okay. Wow, callers, huh?
Oh, you're driving.
Well, Bill, first of
driving,
all,
not crying.
Bill, first of all, let me just back up just a little bit. At what point would you say a wrestler should even consider a character? I guess at one point in their initial training, should they be trained all the way and all the fundamentals, all the bases before they consider a character? Or should they be considering a character, you know, at some point during their training as part of their overall presentation?
Actually, very smart question.
Thank you.
Way often, more than not, young people coming to the business today have already established who they think they want to be without any context for how they're going to accomplish that. They've decided they're going to be Bucky McPherson. They've got this character. You know, it's what they're going to do.
Right.
And that's their guy. But they only have done that because that's the fantasy they built. They haven't figured out how do I get that guy over and why do I get that guy over and why do people care? Which, you know, the key things in wrestling are the hows, the whys, and the care. And the care is the key. And when people care, it has to be that they like you or they don't like you. And why they don't like you, which is important. And so you can come up with any number of characters. Any monkey can come up and decide there's a character. You can come
sure.
up with a character any day of the week.
Sure.
But it doesn't mean you can execute it on a bigger stage. So that's the biggest challenge for anybody coming in, is they have to first not determine who they want to be, but they have to understand who they are, because the greatest characters are defined by who people are. I was talking to Scott D'Amore a little bit ago, and we were talking about AJ Styles' recent promo, which people can
right.
critique based on its content and its context. But regardless, most people in the industry I've talked to who matter think it's one of his better performances, and that Dixie was able to stand up to that performance. Why was it a good performance? If it was, it would be because he believed what he was saying. And the key of establishing a character is believing who that character is. So it's difficult, as Vince did in the 80s, just to hand a character to somebody and hope they're going to embrace it and make something out of it. And rarely did that happen, honestly.
Now, if you want to go to the flip side of that, you know, devil's advocate side for the AJ Styles promo, I'm talking about the initial one, not the one from last week, you know, the first one he went out there and talked. If you want to go the other side, yes, he believed what he was saying, but it lost the crowd.
Ah, and you assume that the crowd is a TNA audience. And unfortunately, they happened to be in a building that was a wrestling crowd that was there for the stars they knew. It wasn't a TNA crowd. It's the problem of going on the road. And every company's had it at different times, and that one was just simply vivid. AJ did a promo that, in theory, a TNA crowd would have responded to. Are you with me? No, we want to say yes. Yay, wrestling. You know, or, you know, what? And that's what they were doing. They were paying attention to basic wrestling, not necessarily to the product that TNA was delivering. It was a mistake in terms of forum if that was the promo they wanted to get over most. But if you watch the promo and you ignore the crowd and pay attention to what he said, then in storyline progression, it actually leads somewhere, I think, very positive. But yes, that was a bad crowd for that night for that promo. It was unfortunate. If they had done that
okay.
in a variety of other places, it would have gotten over huge. And the
like
response he got the second time would have been the same.
Well, it maybe should have been done. I'm trying to remember, was that done on the first taping or second taping? Second taping, I think, right? I'm trying to remember, was that
The initial promo, maybe the first taping, but it was in a non-TNA town, if there is such thing as a TNA town.
Right.
But
yeah,
the reality
say,
is there's certain places TNA is popular as opposed to just more wrestling.
Okay,
and,
in a popular TNA town, you know, there's been criticism of that particular promo that what he was saying actually hit too close to home. You don't want to tell the people that this product sucks. You don't want to say that to people. And this is a promo that a guy would do leaving a territory, not a guy that's sticking around.
Or you would present that as the problem and then follow it up with the solution. Again, he's a babyface abandoning the company. I agree. You're right. But then, potentially, he's able to come back in and suck them back in that he is there to win the end fight. He may have become disillusioned. But at the same time, dumb example, old school. Tommy Rich gets injured and he's hurt. He's upset. He may never come back. And then they do vignettes with him walking through a field talking about how he's been soul searching. Why is he coming back after the agony he's had? This generation is different because everything is tied to the business of the company more than the activity of the wrestlers at times. So unfortunately, the stories in every company that's involved in television right now involve the company. It's the only way any of these people have decided they can get their product over is to talk about what they're doing and involve their people.
What would you say
and
to people that...
The only thing I can defend is that if you're going to involve anybody with TNA, if you don't involve AJ, you're probably making a mistake because nobody else is better branded the company than he could possibly be.
What would you say
except
to people
Jeff Jarrett,
that...
And he's not there.
Well, he's there. He's there. He's getting stronger every day behind the scenes if the rumors are true. So... What would you say
I would support Jeff Jarrett having a greater involvement at any time.
Why is that? I'm going off on a tangent here, but why would you support Jeff Jarrett being more involved, having more say?
By all definitions of success, the period of time that Dutch and Jeff booked going into the change that brought Vince Russo in, that followed with Hulk Hogan premiering, that followed with everything that has happened, was the highest rated period of time the company has had. That was the Main Event Mafia, and there is no way to substantiate other than they were wildly successful. It was really good. It was a 1.5 or higher high and a 1.3 low, and for a 6-month period. And the numbers substantiate that. And then Vince took over, and within a 6-month period, the numbers were point somethings by December. Then Hogan came in, and the numbers jumped artificially, but they blew the wad. It was like, you know, the ultimate porn film. Every fucking thing they could have done, they threw at the crowd. Literally. Jeff Hardy comes back. Ric Flair is walking in. Hardy, you know, Nasty Boys can't get in. People are everywhere. You know, every freaking thing you could do, they did on the same show. And then there was no way to follow it. And that's been the reality. Then we're going to go here. We're going to move the show there. We're going to go over here to make it better that way. That's tied to Spike, you know, and it's up to Spike what helps them best because this is a successful show for Spike. But from a creative standpoint, everything after Jeff and Dutch did not succeed what they did. They had better storytelling. They were doing a better job at the time. And they weren't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But they did a better job.
Well, at the risk of going too far off the beaten path here, Bill, I will just say, if you go all the way back to 2002, that the decision that Jeff Jarrett made to go with Vince Russo was arguably the biggest mistake that TNA has ever made, of many mistakes.
Not really at that time.
Well, maybe at that time.
And remember, I was there. I actually know what I'm talking about. when I was there, Vince Russo's involvement was primarily tied to backstage promos and interstitial shit. He did not get the book until he did. He was involved underneath. And then he decided that he was moving away because of his religion thing. And that's when sex ended and he came back and did whatever he did afterward. Because in between, I worked with him in his Christian promotion. But
yes.
Vince was not the devil at the beginning. Most of the stuff people don't like was either Jerry's or Jeff's. That's just the truth. Midgets masturbating in trash cans was not Vince.
Part 10. But Bill, that's the thing, though,
now,
Bill. Is,
I will say that the first time I appeared, one of the few first times I appeared on television, I was hogtied and was laying there, and Vince came in and said, no, he needs to have his clothes off. And I said, no, I'll do my shirt. And so the very first time that I met Vince, he had wanted me naked, hogtied in the back with FU on my body.
That
happens to be.
That proves that Vince Russo invented Skype.
Yeah, it was very much so.
But
in terms of what you blame Vince for and what you blame the overall creative, an awful lot of what people didn't like was as much Jerry as Jeff as Vince. Vince had a voice, but he was not making decisions. And Dutch had as much involvement at the time, too, because I was around all of the production meetings.
But Jeff Jarrett chose Russo over Jerry Jarrett, over his father. Jerry Jarrett has talked at length about his thoughts on Russo, and I know there's a lot of other circumstances that have contributed, but Jeff choosing Russo over Jerry is a large part of why Jeff and Jerry are estranged today.
Vince is a pimple on the ass of the various issues that affect them. And it literally has more to do with a decision Jerry made as it related to TNA as a company and what he hoped Jeff would do at that time with him. Jeff made another decision about what he wanted to do at that time. Vince was literally not involved in that. It had nothing to do with it.
But it came to a point where Jeff chose Russo over his father, as far as the creative goes in TNA.
They
come to a point to that.
No, because you're looking at a window that doesn't have anything to do with what happened. What happened between Jeff and his dad. Vince had nothing to do with what happened to Jeff and his dad. Literally nothing. Trust me, nothing.
I think you're talking about the Russian, right?
Jerry does not like Vince. That's for sure.
Right.
But
yes.
That's not what led to their issues.
Larry, go on. What did you want to say?
Well, I was just going to get back to the topic we started on was character creation and introduce our future weekly guest commentator who's been involved in the creation of many a character on the Georgia scene, Mr. Stephen Platinum.
Hey, guys.
Yay!
How you doing?
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm doing great, Trent. Doing great. And I was fascinated with that TNA discussion, actually. I was dying to chime in, but...
Please do.
Please chime in.
You should.
Talking about the AJ Styles promos, the one thing that TNA is doing that, as far as like gimmick creation or angles, that I think is not successful is they're taking away AJ Styles' thunder with, I think if he's the only one that's saying, it used to be like this, and then it got bad, but we're going to get it back. If he was the only one doing that, I think it would be very effective. But throughout the evening, because I'll watch TNA Impact and just kind of take little notes for myself, really. And I noted that that was the third time that night that somebody had said or implied, it used to be better before. And I think that that's kind of a part of like gimmick creation and promos and angles as well, is leaving things. And it's something that I think in the old school they were very keen on, and nowadays they've gotten away from. Like, I'll notice things repeating themselves throughout a show, and that's Raw or on the indie scene or TNA. And I think that letting things be special, I heard you guys talking about, you know, it's about being special. What's that special thing about you? And that's what a gimmick's around. And nowadays, it seems like there's a lot of same note stuff going on, where they're, you know, even having like multiple gimmick matches in the course of one show when it's not a pay-per-view or a big show. Just little things like that. Like, unfortunately, TNA, I just feel like the show has a certain tone of it used to be better, and that takes away from AJ Styles' thing, because I thought both of his promos were very good. And, you know, and it's some place to take it. It's kind of like turning Dixie Carter heel. I honestly think TNA does too much of this sort of like authority figures who sort of fix everything or destroy everything. It's kind of why I hate the Hulk Hogan as the general manager thing, because heels can't get any traction because he's just going to come and fix it. And it's anyway, I'm getting a little off topic, but yeah, I just wanted to sort of chime in on that, that I thought the AJ Styles stuff was very effective, and that they take away from it by kind of having a couple other things in the show that are similar. So,
by the way, you are 100% right. And that's what we need to talk about. We need to actually, this is intelligent dialogue along a realistic line. AJ's promo wasn't bad. The key was the context in which the promos appeared. How did they set the plate for what he was doing? Steve is 100% right. As somebody who has booked something, you want to make that position as special as possible before you broaden it. You don't want to broaden it before you make it special. You can't do that. If you broaden it, it's not special. So by having multiple people identify, in theory, the same issue in their self-serving promo, the one they wanted to get over, in theory, the main event promo, the one that's driving the company, which, you know, if Dixie's involved, in theory, it's driving the freaking company. That's the one that should be impactful. That's the one that should be unique. And Steve is 100% right. You have to focus on these things if you're going to get over. And again, uniqueness. It whether we're talking about characterization or presentation, you can't do the same thing over and over and then make the payoff unique.
I feel really bad.
You can't do the same spot at the beginning of a match and do better in the comeback.
The guy I feel bad for right now is Chris Sabin, who they're giving him. I mean, he was their world champ a month and a half, 2 months ago, and now he's sort of relegated to doing this sort of, I'm bitter because of my treatment, and so now I'm turning heel, and it just feels very redundant, and you know, it's just like each version of each photocopy gets more and more distorted and less clear. And it's like the gimmick that they're sort of giving him is now feels like it's been done so many times before. There's no way that his is going to be impactful. And he's somebody I particularly look at and just go, man, I think that's something that they could have done something more with. And I just can't help but feel
Sabin
like it's going to be hard to pull
Sabin
it out.
You saw Sabin as I did at the time he was there and where he came out, he was a great babyface. He was somebody the crowd could get behind. So if you're going to have him get bitter, you really need to find the defining moment in which that happens. You know, you have to present something where the crowd is going to get emotionally involved in the decision the guy makes, rather than it being, oh, well, you know, I have the title and, you know, now I'm sorry, this is my spot now.
Yeah, it feels a wee bit arbitrary.
A lot of booking is that.
He's an okay babyface. He's a good talent. He was not world champion material, and the people saw that.
Well, regardless, if you push the guy to the spot and he delivers in the spot for the time you give him, you need to give him a clear direction coming out.
I mean, I mean, there's a bigger problem here. You know, just doing the X Division guys getting a world title shot and then winning the world title every time, is that alone is redundant. And that, you know, if we're in reality situation,
it's not redundant. It's logical based on the people that have competed in that division.
No, because a good little man,
better athletes have competed in that division, and they've been all shapes and sizes. You can't deny that Samoa Joe is a top guy. You can't deny that Chris Daniels is a top guy. You can't deny that AJ is a top guy. And those were the people that helped define the X Division and had, in the theory of TNA's history, the best match ever.
But all things being equal, a good big man should beat a good little man most of the time.
No.
No. All things being equal.
No.
Why not?
All things are never equal.
Oh.
What happens with talent and people. There is no predisposition over who should win. That's actually what creates the expectation of a finish and the ability to do something better.
Well, I was in Louisville when Sabin won the world title from Bully Ray, and there was decent crowd reaction, don't get me wrong, and there was a chance for Sabin, but there wasn't any fervent heat for him. I mean, the people, listen, it's, I don't know if you call it, my term for it is fun heat, which is so prevalent nowadays, but there wasn't anybody really clamoring for him. Because I was there live, in the crowd.
Who did they clamor for?
Who did they clamor for? Well, it's hard to clamor
anybody?
For anybody, to be honest with you. It's hard to. That's, you know, a big problem for wrestling
nowadays. Don't defend. Who did they get behind? Did they get behind anyone? You were there. Who were the crowd behind? Who was the crowd behind and why? And did you know why they were behind them? Part of the process of wrestling is understanding how crowds react and why. Because in theory, those of us who present the product, and Steven's done that, I've done that, you have an expectation of what you want to deliver. So I can only judge sometimes what I do by what people see. That's why edited Larry.
Well, they were behind, let's just the opening match. They were behind Joseph Park in a explosion match against Devon because it was the opening match and the people were hot to see wrestling. They were behind Hulk Hogan when he came out on the ramp.
Then that audience was not aware of the product, right?
To a degree, they were. I'd say kind of in the middle on that.
Okay.
Some were, kind of in the middle. Some were.
Were they accepting the people TNA wanted to be accepted, and were they rejecting the people TNA wanted heat on, or were you not seeing that?
You know, like if you want to say like Manic, you know, won the Ultimate X, the people enjoyed the match, but I don't think they didn't take the Manic as a babyface, for example. So, you know, they might have enjoyed the action.
Did they respond to what happened? But did they respond to what happened?
Yes.
Did they get behind him as a character, or at least what he's being presented as?
No.
Okay.
In
theory, this is what the companies should be doing, and WWE does better than TNA. You need to figure out what you've accomplished as you go into the next thing. And what you're providing is your perspective, which is incredibly valuable. It's just, you know, back in the day, if it was Jerry Jarrett, Dutch Mantel, the people I learned from, they would go out and watch the crowd very closely and not trust that they were booking geniuses, because they understood that in every time you go down a road, there's always a turn to the left and a turn to the right, and you can go straight. And you could reverse. There's all these directions. And sometimes I think the problem our industry has gotten into is that it gets set so much in the story it wants to tell, it forgets the story the audience is buying.
Yeah, and Bill, let me make a very important point here. I think this is really a key point, is when Hulk Hogan comes out, they pop. When Sting comes out, the people pop. But if you're a booker and you're hearing that pop, I think it's way too easy to get drunk on that pop from Hulk Hogan, because long-term wise and business-wise, that's not really an important reaction, because that is not the future of your business. And if you're going on those pops...
To TNA, the value of Hogan and the value of Sting are two totally different animals.
Right.
My
perception. But I'm just saying, if you're
Hogan,
going...
Hogan will never be branded to TNA. No matter what he does, he's always going to be TNA Presents Hulk Hogan. Sting has actually accomplished the ability to be somewhat associated with TNA. Angle has done it brilliantly. And then there's the people TNA have developed, which is a handful of folks.
I'm just saying that Hulk Hogan pop doesn't mean jack shit for business, is what I'm trying to say. So you can't just go on
that
pop.
I wouldn't disagree with that in a heartbeat. It does a lot for Hogan. It does nothing for...
Yes.
Unless it's tied to the company he's representing, then it is irrelevant. Yes.
There's one thing I think is interesting, talking about like the Saban title win and getting to sort of like gimmicks and things like that, is one of my favorite comments on like gimmick creation was from World Class, who I think it was Skandar Akbar that said in one of the documentaries, you know, wrestling is about dragons and dragon slayers. And
yes.
And for TNA, I thought the one knock against having Saban win is they had built Bully Ray up to be this dragon. He's the heel. He's the guy. He's got all the backing in the world with aces and eights. He's unstoppable and clearly supposed to go to Bound for Glory. That's where everybody expects the dragon to be slain, is at Bound for Glory. And Saban, I don't believe, was built up as enough of a dragon slayer. So it while the title change was liked, I just gimmick-wise, they hadn't presented Saban in such a way. I mean, those vignettes were very good of his, like, I came back from this injury and all this kind of stuff. But it's still, it's like, clearly AJ was supposed to be the guy to come out of the thing.
Yes.
And that's why I thought Saban – That's what I would say, is that I thought that they hadn't built up Saban as a dragon slayer worthy of the dragon of Bully Ray that they had created.
You're 100% right. And the reality is Saban was what we refer to magically as a transition guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that spot.
And
to get to the guy
only...
you want to get. And quite honestly, they've not yet set up Bully and Allen. You know, AJ and Bully has not been set up. There's been actually no promotion to do that. AJ's heat right now is with Dixie. He has no heat with anybody else. He's not addressed the champion, and that was the foul. That was the, if you know, I didn't bitch at him about it, but it was the one mistake that was made in the promo, is that at no time did he address, you know, specifically address the name of his opponent in a major way. And the basics of promos and developing talent and creating whatever uniqueness we can for these people is you have to realize the truth of what you're doing and you have to present it. And it has to be honest. It can be a weird fiction, but you have to believe it. So it has to be honest. And AJ did a lot of that very well, but the key piece was, and I'm kicking this guy's ass.
I have a question for everybody in general, I guess, because I totally agree. And for Larry and Trent and Bill, what are the gimmicks right now that are out there, whether it's, you know, shows that you watch or local stuff or WWE? Like, what's a gimmick right now that you feel like that's a great idea and I can see where that will become a big deal? That isn't a big deal yet.
Larry?
The one that will actually become a big deal?
Yes.
None.
Wow.
Well, I've got one that... You got anything else, Larry?
No.
Well, thank you, Larry. I've got one, Stephen, that I popped for huge last week. And people on the internet pop for it, but I don't know that it's going to be a big deal. But Aiden English's singing gimmick in NXT is fantastic. His operatic theme.
Yeah.
Whether that's going to be a big deal, I don't know. But man, that was beautiful what he did. But let's go a step farther. Let's take the Wyatt family, Stephen. Are they a big deal yet to you?
No, I mean, my definition of a big deal would be worked a main event or close to a main event match at a big show.
Okay, can the Wyatt family
the
be
Wyatt,
a big deal?
The Wyatts are a work in progress that were created down in down in Florida. Okay. Jerry Taylor had a lot to do with that, as he did the Matadors that are coming up. And the key right now with WWE is to create characters, hopefully get somebody over, and once they get them over, find something to do with them. So nobody you're seeing now, right now, based on the people I know are involved in the system, I can't see them hot-shotting anybody to being a player, because they're going to play with what they have and they're going to try to develop these other people and see what happens. Like when The Rock came in the first time, he was the Intercontinental Champion. He was Rocky Maivia, and nobody liked him. They booed him. Rocky sucks. They had to repackage him, bring him back with the Nation of Domination, blah, blah, blah. That was in a different time and a different place and an awful lot more patience. The odds that Rock would have gotten that shot today are more limited than they were then.
Yes.
So all these people being thrown they're literally being thrown at the wall to determine whether they're going to get over. Right now, WWE is going to develop 100 to 120 people at a time in their facility, spending millions, and their intent is to get guys packaged for 5 to 15 years. They have interest in folk that have been there, done that in Buffalo, because those are short-term projects.
I'll say that
TNA stars.
The Shield is a great example of, like, I mean, they came on pretty quick, and their timing, you know, timing is a lot of this too, is they filled a need. They filled a need, and clearly, you know, they've been set up as these, like, vital, vital antagonists for Daniel Bryan. And that's why I think wrestling will still surprise. It's nice to be surprised. And I guess that's another part of gimmicks, is it's nice when something kind of takes shape and takes flight for a little bit. Even the Fandango thing, like, he's probably not going to main event for, you know, 3 or 4 years, if that. He'll have to be repackaged or whatever. But just the fact that something can kind of come out of the blue shows how much audiences appreciate a gimmick, because I think it allows them to be involved vote on what they like.
Yeah. And Johnny Curtis, the guy that's in that spot, came down and did wild side spots in 2002 and 3. That's how long he's been trying to get this opportunity. You know,
going back to Steve's initial question, I guess the thing for me is that I see a lot of things that entertain me, intrigue me, but what I don't see are the ones that are going to translate into being a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that lack of patience is such a huge problem these days.
You have to be willing to go all the way with a character. You cannot cut their fucking nuts off. How many characters have had their nuts cut off and then they going forward, they're castrated? We've seen it over and over. If you actually develop a character, and this character is supposed to be slotted at the top, you know, that's a difficult thing to get them there, but you have to make the commitment top to bottom to go all the way. Do Stephen, Bill, agree or disagree?
I agree, and as Stephen probably will at some level too, but I'll be short. The key for me is you have to care about the people that you're putting in the positions, step one. You have to establish the person you care about. Then you have to establish the person that is an issue with that guy. And if you do that successfully, you can actually accomplish something. Beyond that, the push for the guy you put in the position as the baby face from the beginning depends on how they do in the first spot, and the push for the guy in the heel spot depends on the same. How much did they accomplish? When it's a marriage, it can be long-term. You can book those guys for years. I've frequently booked people for over a year when it works. And right now, that's the thing I see the greatest difficulty in, is that wrestling hasn't figured out how to create feuds that are long enough that they always matter. Stories that mean something from years ago to today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important. If you look at the TV shows you want to love, you know, I'm right now learning to like Breaking Bad. I've watched the first season, and I understand that Steven's a fan. And I've fallen in love with these characters, and I can already see so many directions they go in because they got the guys over. And that's the greatest problem we're having in wrestling right now, is we're hot-shotting almost everybody to the spot they have without giving them enough meat on their bones that we can do more with them inevitably.
I would add to that this. I think, and this could either be brilliant or completely full of shit, so please tell me. I have a theory that the WWE developed this formula, which is you give guys a gimmick. I'll use John Cena as an example. There's John Cena, how they brought him in, which is sort of like generic wrestler guy. And then they gave him the rapping thing. And then as he got closer to the main event, they started stripping him of aspects of his gimmick so he could be a main event guy. Somewhere along the lines, they have got it in their head that once you make the main event, you don't do a lot of the gimmick stuff that got you to the dance, that there's a difference between being a main event guy and the gimmick that got you there, that you have to be more serious. Your wrestling style becomes simpler and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's part of the problem is wrestlers coming up, see the guys who are in the main event. They see like Triple H or Rock or whatnot. And they go, well, those guys don't have to do a character, or they don't have to do anything silly, or they don't have to do any of that stuff, and they're main event guys. So I'm going to model myself on the John Cena that comes out, salutes, and then he's the never say die baby face. I'd rather do that than have to wear a chain and a lock around my neck and do a silly rap or something like that. Because see, when he was doing that, he wasn't as big of a deal. Now he's this. And so I think guys don't recognize that's a WWE thing. And it hasn't always been the case.
Honestly, very much so. Yeah. Because if you look at, as an exception, because this happened within the last 5 years or so, when Angle was getting over in WWE, he was a comedy character with credibility, and he was able to translate that to the greater credibility he's had ever since. And AJ is now in TNA getting a chance at various times to branch out from being just the guy that can wrestle. I don't see WWE creating that window of opportunity for people to really break out on their personality. Punk and Brian and Daniel Bryan, bless their hearts, are the two that have actually accomplished it. And it's weird because they literally expose the fact they're not happy. You know, the Daniel Bryan thing is not what they do because, you know, Hunter is basically saying you're this little guy, which he believes. You know, whether he believes it or not, he really doesn't believe he can carry the ball. And Punk, they fired twice, or actually they were supposed to. I mean, when I was working with the company, Dreamer was supposed to fire him two different times. And he didn't, thank goodness, for Punk's career. And Punk has been able to establish simply a character. He's been able to uniquely get over based on more or less the character he created. It's one of the very few examples. Daniel Bryan slightly, although he's just become this bearded guy.
But I think it does prove it shows the merit of Steve's point in that those are the two exceptions I would point to as well, as far as they didn't strip away their character as they moved
the
main event.
They don't push the straight edge thing down your throat anymore, which was sort of an integral part of him, I thought.
Very much so. And the key right now with both of them is they've become somewhat bastardizations, but very similar to the characters they augmented, created, and perpetuated on the indies, rather than it appears from the outside looking in that they're being totally adjusted by the writing team. That's at least how I look at those characters. Whether I'm right or not doesn't matter. But if I'm looking at it that way, and I think it's a positive thing, it's a good thing. Most other people I see revolving around WWE's show appear to be overly scripted. It's overly done, artificially created. TNA, because they're not as good at writing right now, there are windows of opportunity for people to break out. Whether anybody does at any great level depends on how people, again, that's, you know, AJ's my client, so obviously, I'm going to kiss that ass. But regardless, anything they give him a chance to do that allows him to expose the personality he has, as opposed to just being the phenomenal guy, I'm going to be a happy camper.
I want to address Steven's point. Steven, when John Cena first came up as a prototype, he was close to being cut. He rapped in front of Stephanie McMahon, and that's what got him his slot. And you're right, over the years, they slowly took the rapping away from him. But I think what happens when a guy gets on top and a guy gets that big, it becomes a point of let's not mess with success. Let's not fix it if it's broken. I would even say there's fear in there. You know, it's like John Cena, he had a wardrobe change. He went from fucking jean shorts to khakis. That's not a fucking wardrobe change. You know what I mean? Once a guy gets that high, they're not going to change in mud because they don't want to mess with the formula. But as an add-on to that, at the end of the day, guys, how deep do you think a character needs to be in professional wrestling? This is not Breaking Bad. This is pro wrestling. Going forward, should we expect characters to be more than one-dimensional? I mean, this pro wrestling, don't we just want people to go yay and boo at the end of the day?
Well,
wrestling is Breaking Bad and should be. Wrestling should be perceived as the same kind of aggressive storytelling that establishes characters that matter and gives you a reason to believe in them regardless of their motivations. There, you know, one of the areas Vince Russo and I argued about all the time was Vince Russo said there's no such thing as baby faces and heels. That's wrong.
It's
how you interpret those characters that's correct. You have to be able to understand that for some people, a baby face can be a heel, and for some people, a heel can be a baby face, and how to utilize that to your advantage. The Breaking Bads of the world and the other TV shows that are able to sustain a narrative that makes sense with characters that matter are the exact same thing wrestling is doing at its most pure level. Historically, it did it at a live event format using TV as a supplement to promote the live shows. Today, it's reversed. The television product creates the live product. It was different back in the day. Live product used to be the key. Today, the live product isn't the key. The
gentlemen, what do you say we take a caller? Would you have
when wrestling got started?
What'd you say, Larry?
Okay, if we take a caller, would you have somebody who's been holding for a while? Let's try again.
Please.
Nope, they disappeared. Never mind. They did not. When the time came, they chickened out. They're gone.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now 0-2. That's right.
We're 0-2 on calls.
But however, I'd say our gimmick that we actually had callers instantly elevates us above the other podcast radio shows.
Woo!
Or at least the perception of callers.
Absolutely.
The perception of callers. And Bill, I actually agree with you because my last
perception was reality. Only the person that is looking at the phone knows.
And Bill, I actually agree with you because my last statement was actually more of a tongue-in-cheek, you know, about should characters and wrestlers be deeper. It's interesting to me, like if you talk to, of course, being a fan and talking to wrestlers is always a unique experience, as Larry can expound upon. From a fan, talk to wrestler is very interesting, but sometimes you mention something to a wrestler in a storyline that doesn't really make sense or just kind of bad, and they'll immediately go, hey, man, you know, we don't want to be over the people's heads and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm going through Memphis 1980. I'm going through Smoky Mountain 1993. And there was elaborate stories going on that were not over people's heads. You know, you can do something more
and there were mummies.
Yes.
Absolutely. Prince Karras, yes, there was that too. But I'm just saying it's it doesn't have to be as stupid simple as some people claim it does at all times.
And we were more patient.
Yes.
So you at some level you have to take a step back and understand where you were versus where we are. We're in a more complicated entertainment universe right now with a multiplicity of options and a diversity of intellectual avenues.
And incredibly short attention spans on the part of the people watching.
Say that again, Larry.
Yes.
And incredibly short attention spans.
And a whole lot more creative people doing our television product at many levels because there's things being challenged now that wouldn't have been thought about years ago. You know, All in the Family was innovative years ago, and you look at the stuff that's on TV now, and you would go, holy shit, you know, nobody would have thought of doing that.
But I don't even think it's a short attention span, Larry. That is a perception, but is that really reality? Or is that a created reality?
Yeah, I mean,
hello?
Would the patient approach even work anymore?
Bill?
Yes.
Or Steven?
I think
I'm just watching Breaking Bad now, and I'm one season into what I understand was, but how many are there? Six or seven seasons? I'm losing track. But I'm at the beginning of what seems to be a wonderful adventure with characters that are evolving. And the basic premise is this guy has cancer. He's dealing drugs, and and with every step, he ends up crossing further over the line of debauchery and you know, spiritual sin, in essence. And at the same time, there's a redemption in what he's doing because of, you know, the family he's involved in, the baby that's coming. There's all this other stuff, and they're not rushing it. The greatest angles in wrestling take time. They always will. The greatest angles in any movie take time. The greatest movies take time. There is no great short movie.
Okay, but Bill, a devil's advocate, what is arguably the greatest moment in TNA history?
Honestly, there's several moments, but they're more tied to the introduction of characters than established forward momentum.
What would you say?
I think one of the greatest moments was Kurt Angle's introduction. I think that was a big moment. There were several times in the championship series where they accomplished something. But in general, I would agree with you if you were saying they have not yet stamped WrestleMania moments on the TNA brand.
My answer was going to be, and this took a very short time, so sometimes there is lightning in a bottle, was the very first Samoa Joe and Kurt Angle match. That may be the peak of TNA.
I would see that. I can see that.
But and that was a strong moment. Now, I mean, there were other strong moments.
But I'm just saying that came quickly.
Was disappointing because the payoff was rushed. So they ended up establishing a tremendous back and forth of them beating the crap out of each other in perception or reality, and then they rushed to the end of it without giving it time to breathe. I think that was a huge mistake.
You know, when you look at the buy rates on that pay-per-view, and it's by far the most that TNA ever had.
Yeah.
As a booker, the first thing I thought was, imagine what they could have done if they waited. That was immediately my first thought was, I'm sure in their mind, and they meaning, you know, Russo and whatnot, it was like home run. And I always thought like, but you could have had a home run with people on base. And I think that's the problem is with like the increased pay-per-view schedule and all this other stuff that's happened in the last 10 years. Now the payoffs invariably have to happen quicker because they've educated the audience to expect it. And I don't know, it's a kind of a chicken or the egg argument. I don't know if it's wrestling catering to the audience expectations or vice versa. But all I know is I don't know if you can put the toothpaste back in the tube. And TNA is trying, certainly, by cutting back their pay-per-view schedule. But then I look, you know, the shows that they've done that are linked to pay-per-views, like, you know, now that they just call, you know, they just pick one Impact a month and call it whatever the pay-per-view is. Those have done better ratings-wise, but again, it's because they're sort of focusing a lot of stories to have big moments or angles to wrap up on these Impact shows. So I don't know. I would, I love to think, I mean, Bill can speak to this. I mean, I think Anarchy does a phenomenal job of letting stories develop over time.
Yes,
and
yes.
And that's why, I mean, this, I always get in trouble for saying stuff like that, but that's why I'm here, right? Is I don't consider that there's only two leagues in Georgia that I go, they're expert storytellers. And that would be Anarchy, and I think PCW at its best as well. There are other groups that do have stories, but they always show signs of not knowing how to pay them off, or not, or being, or pulling the trigger too soon or too late. And I think that's a big problem for me, just as somebody who still has a promotion, and I look around because I go, like, the guys themselves, the wrestlers, get this, I hate to say it, but a lot of them develop these senses of entitlements because of how other promotions are run. So in other words, the championship belt is something that you get for attendance. You know, it's like, well, so-and-so deserves it, quote-unquote,
yeah,
because they've been there a long time or whatnot, as opposed to what it should be is, you know, the something that helps accentuate the stories that you're trying to tell, however you want to call that. If you want to call the Vince Russo prop theory or whatever, but I just see you're like, gosh, I feel bad because it's like the guys are not getting put in positions where they can learn how stories are being told over an extended period of time. It's somebody posted this recently, and I couldn't agree more. It's like, heel and face have a problem. Next show, cage match.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the
indies.
Yeah.
And I always think
Stephen, you're so right on this shit. You know, I have it all the time. I like taking time with things. You took time with things, and payoffs needed to matter. I think an added wrinkle is not just the necessarily the way that people book. Some people really don't book. Some people just do what I call matchmaking. They put cards together. But those that think they're booking, frequently the talent undercuts the patience in that they let the people that are involved determine how they're getting over in the angle they've been given. One thing I've always tried to maintain with what little I've been able to do is nobody decides what's going on but me. I told people when they didn't like it, let me make the mistake. If it's going to be bad, then it's my fault. But I see frequently on a lot of other shows that the vision is a collaboration that doesn't necessarily have a center ground. It's skewed toward the person collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't get a story, they get a payoff because that person's looking for their reaction, not the greater reaction of the overall show. If you're going to book shows, you have to look beyond the singular focus of any one or any one entity.
I will say from the shows that I attend around Georgia that I would agree with what Bill just said about 1,000%. And that what seems like both Steve and Bill, you're both doing is laying the blame at the feet of the bookers as far as for the lack of success that, you know, it seems to be a general problem these days as I look around.
Yeah, I mean, I'll get specific because that's more interesting to me. In like UIW is a prime example, right? Like they're willing to open up the checkbook, right? And they bring in, you know, they bring in Jeter, and you have Jeff G. All these elements that you also have at Anarchy, and they have Murder One. They opened up the checkbook to compete with Peach State, but they can't book for shit. They don't know how to even put
a
car together.
They create a compelling setup for a show.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, well, what's next? Well, I don't know if he's available next. Oh, we'll have to go to this. I'm just waiting, you know, eventually it'll be Rob Adonis and Barry Buchanan in the main. You know, it's going to end up being the same thing at some level without a story. It just becomes a series of matches. And there's a difference between matchmaking and booking. There's a difference between promoting and booking. And anybody who doesn't understand that's not paid attention either. For example, I am a terror. I tried. I can draw a crowd, but it pains me deeply because I have to work hard at it. An exceptional promoter. He gets asses into seats because that's how he pays his rent if somebody else isn't paying it for him. So those are the realities. I mean, the difference between Bert Prentice, when I worked with him, I never worried about whether we were drawing a house. I worried about the product because he punted the product.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I'll go ahead and name names. I'm not afraid because I don't watch UIW, but I'll say straight up that Murder One is the worst booker of the year.
Ouch.
I think Demetis is booking to make sure he continues to get paid and hangs on to the spot he has.
I don't know how you even call it booking. They've got some good talent there. It's a small crew. They got some good matches, but booking, it's the pits.
Yeah,
You
know, Sacred Ground is coming up for PCW, and it's our big show of the year. And
yes.
I was lamenting this year a couple months ago that I'm like, the major angles only started at, you know, Revolutionary War Games, which is July 4th. So July, August, September. So because I'd only had 3 months of build, I felt like that wasn't enough. And I was actually distraught over it, and then people had to tell me, that card is really good. Like, you don't have to worry, and Sacred Ground's a big enough thing that took years to establish that people will come. But to me personally, especially after Sacred Ground 3, which was the payoff of an angle that literally went for 2 years, like, it just felt, you know. And again, I wish more guys were worried about that or thought about things like that. Like, man, we only built up
for
3 months.
And Stephen, the more you do those things, more you define your company's brand. Who are you? What do you matter? What matters in your company? What defines you? I'm blessed that people remember things better than I do that I accomplished in Wildside and to a somewhat lesser extent in Anarchy, just because of the different times that it was and the people involved. But all I know is that I never wanted to feel like I was hot-shotting my shows. Even when I bring in a Dusty Rhodes, there was a reason. You know, he didn't just show up because it was Tuesday. There was a reason for him to be there, and it made perfect sense with everything else that was booked before him, and he didn't draw the house. He was gravy. I always thought it was important to do those kind of things, and I don't see as much of that. Using the Dusty example, most people would draw their house because Dusty's there.
Right, or it's like the Peach State Hacksaw Jim Duggan thing. He comes in.
We were doing,
yeah.
Regardless of whether Dusty was there.
To contrast, I thought it was interesting that Trent brought out Murder One as the example of a bad booker. When you look at the guy that was there before, Jimmy Rave, especially for a time, he was the slow burn guy, and I thought it was very effective at Rampage. If anything, sometimes it seemed like there should have been other stuff like paying off faster. That's just a general impression. But I never got the sense that he didn't know where things were going. Like, he didn't know where things were going to go. And, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
And now, I mean.
My only problem with Rave, and Bill, you were there at the time, was I thought it got to a point where there were too many multi-team matches, and they kind of blended together after a while. They were too much the same kind of matches.
And there's no greater way to explain that than
Certain things happened that affected what we intended to be the payoffs to various things that had more to do with life than it had to do with booking. And the end game ended up not being what we were aiming for, so some of it got convoluted near the end because it's just what we had to do at the time.
Well, Stephen, let me ask you real quick, I guess we'll have to wind this down here at some point. This has been really fun, guys, but I just want to ask you, because you've probably been as good as anyone as creating characters in your promotion, what is your process of creating the character for the talent? How do you do it? What's your process?
This is just in general, because, of course, there's every different gimmick has a totally different story, but in general, especially in the kind of earlier years, it was, what's a need that we have? So it might be like, I feel like we need like a mid-card white meat baby face. And then I would either create that thing myself or I would find a guy who I thought could fit the bill. That's how the process began, is filling a need. So a specific example. I need the ultimate heel. And I'm bringing this guy up because I know Bill hates it. But, like, I need the ultimate heel. And I went, what's somebody that nobody can get behind, like legitimately can get behind? And I went, a white supremacist. And then I sort of looked around, and I looked at Will. And I just
Little
went,
Willie.
Little Willie. And I was just like, I hate the Little Willie thing. Hate it. And then he came to training once, and he had like camo shorts and a wife beater and that short cropped haircut. And as a joke, when he stepped in the ring, I said, "Hey, welcome to practice, Dwight Power." And everybody laughed. And I just went, like I listen to all kinds of stuff, like sports talk radio and conservative radio. Like, I listen to all that stuff just to hear like ideas that are being kicked around. And I just went, oh, what if I had a guy that sort of embodied, what if Glenn Beck was allowed to be how he really wanted to be and beat people up? And I was just like, let's make that a gimmick. People didn't like it. They really didn't like it outside of PCW, but within PCW, you know, when Simon Sermon came in, and his gimmick I didn't give to him, but booking him as a face was definitely on me. Because I said, we're in Atlanta. They're not going to boo a gay character, and I don't want them to boo a gay character. And so it's like, let's set the two of them up at the Jungle, which will be like half the audience will be gay, and let Dwight Power do his thing and feud with Simon Sermon and see if we can run with that on top. So that's – and another example is I wanted a monster heel. And we just didn't have that guy because I felt like Jeter and other guys that were bigger still weren't kind of like needed to be developed. So I created one. So it's like grotesque. I'll make that monster heel gimmick, and I'll just, you know, push it over the top and go for it that way. So usually the gimmicks are formed because of need. I wanted a Rey Mysterio. I wanted somebody who could connect with the kids because Porter Dale was a very different audience for us. And I wanted a gimmick that would connect with the families that were coming. And I just went like, what's hot? I literally went to my friend Matt Myers, like, what's hot right now? And he goes, zombies and stuff. Zombies and vampires. And I went, huh. And so then I came up with Supernatural. You know, it's like, let's have a luchador, but let's have a luchador who kind of does this like creepy zombie thing, but he'll be a face. And people are like,
so Steve, from what you're saying, it's not really looking at the individual and drawing from within them. It's really the need that comes from the promotion.
Yeah, because there were other people slated to be Supernatural first. Actually, Mystic Storm is the first because he wrestled in a mask, and I had never seen him wrestle before, but he came in, looked at a PCW show. And then I sort of suspected, like, he might not be able to do what I want with this gimmick, you know. And then so he ended up not being Supernatural. And then, you know, Taco, like, I looked at his stuff, and I went, oh, he's a guy who's willing to throw his body around. Like, he does pretty spectacular spots. But yet, he hadn't done anything with the character that he was given at Wildside and hadn't evolved it. And I thought, like, he's a perfect guy to kind of bring in
yes.
who will seem brand new and fresh and give him this supernatural gimmick and just see where it goes. And where are we at? We're at, you know, Supernatural and Chip Day, of all people, who was always booked a certain way.
Yeah.
I booked them a little different, and now they're our main event at Sacred Ground. It's pretty crazy, you know. So.
Steve and I don't disagree, but one of the things I've done slightly differently is I've skewed toward trying to find characters that immediately launch off what that person is as best I figure out who the hell they think they are. Most kids that come into wrestling have predisposed their character without any thought. They've given themselves a name. You know, they're going to be, you know, Spongy McMuffin. That's their name. They're coming in with that guy. And
right.
they have no idea what they're doing with that, but that's who they've been, and they've created the outfit, and they've done that since they were 13. So usually when people come in, I have to figure out where they are. I'll give an example. And these are at least one person that Steve worked with. We had Tommy Daniels and C.B. Gibson, and they came in, and they were doing a tag team. Tommy had been working as an underdog guy for Steven, you know, he'd been sort of the winner. You know, he ended up winning even though God knows why he could. And I saw both of them, and the first thing I thought is, did you guys just throw last names into a bin? And, you know, you went, oh, let's see. All right, Morton. No, hang on. No, I don't want like that one. Gibson. Yeah, I'll take that one. You know, how do they come up with these really shit names? And so then eventually it got to, one day, C.B. Gibson was sitting there, and he was just sort of smiling, going, I think I need to be something like Rico Suave, C.B. Suave. And I said, so what? And you're going to be full of yourself and oil your body and, you know, be just, you know, toast this? He goes, yeah. I go, okay, good. Go do that. And then I was talking to Tommy, and I said, what's your name? And he said, Tommy Pennarelli. And I went, Italian then. Yeah, I'm full-blooded Italian. And he was pretending he was cocky about it. And I went, all right, well, fine, entertaining, because here you are, a little teeny Italian guy that nobody would ever get to. Tremendous. You know, I like that. That works. And so we changed their names to that. And at least what I've tried to do minimally with the people I've worked with is try not as much as possible just to throw something at them, no matter how badly they do it, but rather try to find something that is who they are that they haven't really realized. You know, like an example of doing the best you can with somebody you got. We had the Monster Pain. You may have seen the Monster Pain.
Yes.
He's very intimidating.
Yes. Yes.
The Monster Pain, we had him at the Rampage, and he was about half the size he is now, cause so he was less a monster. But we wanted to make him impressive, and I looked at him and goes, nobody's going to believe this guy's going to beat up Barry Buchanan. You know, nobody's going to believe this guy's going to beat up AJ Steele. They're too big, and this is not a big guy. He may be wide at various times, but he's not that big. And he's not that impressive, and he's not that scary. So I gave him the Asiatic Spike. The only way I thought that we could possibly get him over, and we used that, and, you know, we got him over on Doc Gayton with that and allowed him to be a monster, the Monster Pain. But that's an example of not a character I believed in, but rather a go-to spot. And I think there's both of those in what you do with people. Sometimes you simply try to get the best you can out of the people you have. And other times you try to give them the real direction and try to stop them from doing the stupid shit that they were going to do on their own. You know, look, to this day, I will never understand why Scotty Wren, a person I used back in the day who actually was fairly influential, ever became Scotty Wren. His name is Jason Justice. That's his real freaking name. And I got Brian Casey. His real name was Brian Casanova.
Casanova, yes.
And you're sitting there going, what the fuck? You know, you're trying so hard not to succeed. Bless your heart. So those are the challenges of creating the characters. For me, the key is, and I know Steve does this because, quite honestly, Taco could not be supernatural if he didn't believe he can be that guy. When I used that character, he wasn't able to believe it. In Steven's promotion, he does. And that's a problem, because if you're going to be the character everywhere, you have to believe the character, and the promoter booking it has to allow you to maintain it. But you have to live up to the character. You have to be able to deliver it.
And that's the exact problem. When I watch NXT, Bill, you can tell a lot of those guys are playing the character force on them, but they're not embracing it, and they do not believe it. It jumps off the screen at me.
And going back to the name thing for a second, could WWE be any
way they create the characters? Yeah.
Could WWE be any worse with names? All
those names.
Two-syllable, easy-to-pronounce last names. They all sound the same.
Those names, yeah.
I don't know if it's true, but I've heard that the guys...
I remember when Matt Sydal called me when he was backstage the first time he went out, and I forget the name they had given him, but it was hideous. And we couldn't come up, and we were sitting there fighting, trying to come up, and he says, I don't know what to do. I like Evan. I went, why? I said, I don't know. I went, okay. we're like just throwing things at a wall, and somehow he had just seen one of the Bourne movies.
Wow.
And that's how Evan Bourne got started. And then he went, they want me to cut a promo. Oh, shit. All right. So then we're going, well, what's the thing? So it's, you know, it basically, I gave him an Amazing Red Expect the Unexpected promo, but I just reworded it. But it was basically the same promo. There's only so many of those you can do. But that's how he basically got his spot, is they threw a name at him that sucked. He came up with something that sucked less. I got a spot out of it.
Well, gentlemen, we promised ourselves that we were not going to overstay our welcome, that we were going to stick with the less is more philosophy. So I think it's probably a good time to, there probably is no good time, but it's as good a time as any to wind this show down.
You haven't said what Steven's doing. You haven't said what Steven's doing in the future, what he's coming in, what he's doing. He's contributing.
Oh, yes. Got to put that gimmick over.
Yes.
Tell him, Bill. Tell him, Bill, what is Steven doing in the future, Bill? Tell us.
We are going to come out here and pretend we know what we're doing, and then Steven's going to come in later in the show and talk vividly about some key subject that simply bothers him.
Yes. Full disclosure.
I hope I'll be able to have something that bothers me every week. That would be amazing.
No, actually,
not only I have no idea how you'll do that.
Well, Steven, I got good news. We're only going to be a once a month show, so you got a whole month to build up something to get
this
right.
Boy. Less pressure, Steve. Only once a month you need this.
Yes. So. Surely to God, within a month I'm going to piss you. It's going to be that time of the month, Steven. Come on.
Nicely done.
So we will be back sometime in the month of October. Before we go, a couple quick things. Bill, I want to say you did a tremendous job of representing your client, AJ Styles, throughout this show.
Yes.
He should be very pleased. A couple quick plugs. October 5, to see the fine work of these two wonderful bookers we have joining us on this show, Sacred Ground 3 in Porterdale on October 5, Fright Night 2013 in Cornelia, Georgia on October the 26th. Any other closing comments before we're out of here?
Absolutely not. I had a ball, guys. Can't wait for the next show.
Cool.
Thank you.
We'll see you.
See you next month, guys. Thank you, everybody. Bye.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.